Today we're going to continue our series of broadcasts on Monday mornings called Listening to Ladies. It originates as a podcast and website created by Elizabeth Blair. She's a Kalamazoo-based composer herself who wanted to discover and showcase the work of other women composers. On previous episodes, which you can hear by going to WMUK.org or by the listeningtoladies.com website, Blair traveled to San Francisco to talk to Pamela Zee and to Toronto to talk to Canadian composer Anna Hostmann. I asked Elizabeth how she found the subject of her next episode, Augusta Ciccone Bates.
She wrote me. She found out about me somehow or other and wrote me last spring and said, you know, hi, I'm an 83-year-old composer and I've written a lot of operas and I'm an Italian-American and would you like to interview me? And I said, yes, I would. So on my way back from what I did was I took that trip to Toronto and then I basically curved around and then came down through the west part of New York State where she lives and met up with her at this little farmhouse, which is in the middle of nowhere. And there's no neighbors. You can't really see anybody for, you know, just a long ways. There's just fields. And then this little house is sticking up with a barn and wow. Garden. And yeah, and she has 12 cats.
Wow.
12. Yeah, it was quite the experience.
Now here you're talking to someone of a completely different generation. Do you get nervous trying to think of ways to connect and conversational touch points?
I used to, and then I worked for a year as the activities director for an assisted living, and there were about 30 folks that lived there, and most of them were over 80 and many of them were over 90, and I was the only activity staff, so I worked with them all day long, all of them. Doing everything from music to art to just conversation to card games to bingo to crafts to outings to gardening, you know, all these things. And I found that the most sought after activity of them all was conversation. That's what they all enjoyed. That's what I enjoyed. I mean, these other things were just vehicles for conversation. And so I had some of the most wonderful conversations of my whole life every day at that job and learned so much about communicating across generations and so much about listening and about receiving rather than necessarily having, because so many of these folks need to speak. They need to talk about their life and they need to reflect and they need to joke and laugh and they need to... It is a delight now for me to speak to people in the older generations and an honor because I've had so much practice and I seek after it. I love it. I think it's fantastic. I think everybody should. I think despite the fact that you'll run into a lot of old-fashioned views, there is so much wisdom. And that's not even the right word. It's not wisdom. It's not like they're founts of wisdom sitting on a mountaintop ready to tell you what to do with your life. It's just, they've just been around longer than you and you need to listen to what they have to say.
Augusta herself was more than happy to share. She sounds so full of opinions and self-confidence, actually.
You know, one of the things I had to cut out for lack of time was an entire story about how in 2007 she really lost that confidence. She had one too many rejections, one too many, you know, foiled plans to get one of her operas performed, and she fell into a really deep depression. And I wasn't able to keep that for time constraints in the episode, but it was a really beautiful story about how she came out of that and how she's now just feeling like she has a second chance and how she, you know, this is both her second and her last chance is what she sort of how she described it. This is her time. It's now or never, you know. If she doesn't get stuff done now, she's not going to get it done. And, you know.
Does she still actively compose?
Yes, she does. Very much. Yes. And she still has works performed. Certainly, especially in Toronto and in Canada, she tends to cross the border a lot for her performances. And so she may sound confident now, but I think part of that confidence, and I don't want to pat myself on the back, but part of it is when somebody comes to listen to you speak about your career, you know, it really helps. It gives you a boost of confidence. And in fact, at the very end, and she wasn't this kind of person, she wasn't the kind of person to give many compliments. But at the very end, you know, she came back out to my car when I was already in my car, and she said, you know, you just made me feel like $1 million. And I felt like $1 million as well. And we just, it was like we were healing each other just by this interaction and this sharing of stories. Yeah.
That's Elizabeth Blair, who created the Listening to Ladies podcast and website, listeningtoladies.com. Here's her episode with Augusta Ciccone Bates here on WMUK.
I'm Elizabeth Blair, and this is Listening to Ladies.
You want to? Yeah, sure.
I met Augusta Ciccone Bates at her farmhouse in Cape Vincent, New York.
Whoops. Come on, Patchy.
Come here, honey.
Come on. Come on. She said, really?
Not far from the St. Lawrence River and close to the Canadian border. We sat on her front porch because it was a beautiful day in May. She was born about 90 miles away in Syracuse, New York, and her parents were Italian immigrants.
I was born in 1933, so I'm a Depression child, and they tell me that if you're born between the years of 1928 and 1938, you're a member of the lost generation. My mother used to tell us that, so I thought it was kind of funny.
She was an only child.
Depression was kind of difficult. Nobody was working, and they didn't know how they would support another child, so they really didn't have another child. But there were always books and learning. The emphasis was on learning and knowledge in my house.
Her mother was especially interested in art.
She had a book of historic paintings, and we looked through that every once, and she'd say, this one's by a woman. You know, she knew to emphasize that women could do things. So she was way before her time.
I asked her if she came from a family of musicians.
No, but my mother, they loved Italian opera. Mm-hmm. And every time they could get a recording, they bought one. So I grew up with probably great music. We weren't too much into symphonies, but Italians really aren't anyway. You know, they really like to sing.
Augusta never took voice lessons, though. Just piano, which she started at age 6.
Problem was, when I was playing piano stuff, I'd rather play it the way I figured it had to go rather than the way it was written. And she said, you're not composing yet. And I said, well...
So, when she was a kid, had she heard of any women composers?
There was one back in the Middle Ages named Caccini.
Here she's talking about Francesca Caccini, who lived from 1587 to around 1645. She was an Italian composer of the Baroque era.
And somehow, I used to think that we were somehow descended, because Ciccone and Caccini could be very similar, but my mother said no, because they were from Florence and we were from Rome. But I was amazed that she wrote music, you know.
She also heard the Clara Schumann Piano Concerto, and she thought,
wow, this is a woman that wrote this, you know. So by the time I was 8 or 9 or 10, I was beginning to think, maybe I could do that.
That was from Spring Peepers, the final movement in the Tug Hill Suite. The Tug Hill Tomorrow Land Trust protects the land around Watertown, New York.
In the conservancy, the idea is to make sure that land still remains land and they don't build high-rises all over the place on stuff. I mean, they want to keep some wildlife, and it's a very, very fine organization.
They were celebrating their 10-year anniversary in 2005, and they commissioned a chamber orchestral piece from Augusta for the celebration. That was Gaggle of Geese, the first movement of the Tughill Suite. She was the valedictorian of her class, and she went on to attend Syracuse University. She wanted to study piano, but according to her, she wasn't good enough, so she did a program in humanities, which was, in effect, music history. And even though she wasn't majoring in composition, she was still taking lessons and classes.
I really began writing music when I was at Syracuse University, and I had two or three pieces performed there.
One of her teachers was organist Joseph McGrath. She studied both organ and composition from him.
Wrote a couple of masses. You know, I mean, he was Catholic, you write a mass, you know. And then I wrote a few hymns and stuff like that. But, you know, that wasn't really, they were really not what I really wanted to do, you know. So McGrath said to me one day, he said, why don't you try writing a string quartet? I said, I don't know enough about strings to put in a bucket. And he said, just write it.
So she did.
And in 77, I entered my string quartet in a competition out of Vermont, and I won it. And I thought, must be I'm doing something right.
Composing was something that came very naturally to her.
You know, I remember one time I saw a film about Cole Porter, and he said that he could read the newspaper and hear a melody. And I thought, gee, that's the problem I have. You know, I mean, I really liked setting words to music. Pure music was a little more esoteric for me. I had to still, for me to write a string quartet, I had to think in terms of words first, and then I'd have a melody and work from there.
I asked her about those texts. She said she used E.E. Cummings and Stephen Crane. She also used Crane's poems later on when she was writing vocal works. He actually went to Syracuse University, too, for a little while in the 1890s.
He was a very sarcastic poet. He wrote, "War is kind." Well, war isn't kind, but that's the sardonic meaning of that. And I said that.
She related an interesting story of having a piece on a program alongside another composer, who was also a woman. After the concert, she was approached by the composer, who said,
"Your music is so strong." That was always the comment that women and men would make about the music. It was strong, very defined music. I said, well, I like it loud, and I like it bombastic, and I like it fighting.
You were just listening to Settlers and Loggers, the second movement of her suite, Essences of the North Country. The third movement is titled Aurora Borealis.
over the Tug Hill, if you're ever there, you can see the northern lights are just phenomenal. It's almost like being in Alaska. They're just so beautiful at night.
The final movement is called Music of the Plateau. For this one, she brought in 8 local fiddlers.
Well, the youngest, I think, was 12, and the oldest was 80. And these guys played this tune in the middle of the piece. And then, of course, the orchestra goes along with it. And so it was really a very, very successful evening. And it was beautiful. Unfortunately, when they recorded it, you can't hear the fiddle. I don't know what happened. Everything else is beautiful, but that fiddle tune isn't clear.
When she was in her 40s, she decided she wanted to do some more studying of composition, but she didn't necessarily want her doctorate. She eventually went to Cornell and worked with teachers there, but first she worked with Brian Israel at Syracuse University. He was a young professor, about 28 when she met him.
See, he was like I am. I could look at a piece of music and hear it, and so could he. And we performed at Syracuse at Cornell University in a recital, and Karel Husa was there for his students were performing.
Karel Husa is a Czech-born classical composer and conductor who was born in 1921 and who won the 1969 Pulitzer Prize for Music.
But at the end of the evening, he came all the way across the auditorium to me and he said, "Such beautiful Italian music. Congratulations." So that was the next step up, I guess. Thank you.
That was Simonetta's song from the series Nei Giardini Medici, in the Medici Gardens, in which she set texts by the 15th century poet Angelo Poliziano.
So, but Brian died at 35 of leukemia. Killed him dead. And he was brilliant.
He was also a staunch defender of his student. She related a time when she, Brian Israel, and another composer were sitting after a concert in which one of her pieces had been performed.
We were seated at a table, and Brian said, "Congratulations, the songs went beautifully." And he said to her, "What do you think?" And she said, "They're so tonal." And looking really down her nose at that. And he just looked at her and he said, "No," he said, "they're cosmic. And if you can't hear that, I have nothing more to say." And he got up and left, and I'm sitting here. I was embarrassed, really, because here I am sitting here. He's just defended me, and she's... So I kind of sat there for a minute or two, and then I excused myself and got a cup of coffee or something, but...
Our conversation later came back around to her feelings about atonality and the ways music changed in the 20th century.
You know, I don't know what they did in the later 20th century. They really massacred music. They just destroyed it. It had to be non-melodic, non-tonal, non-metric. It had to be, well, as one person said to me, "Yeah, they want us to step on a Coke can underneath the chair and make noise with that, and that's music." I'm thinking, boy, you people have got your taste in your feet. Well, they caught on to what music is and what the arts are. The arts are a forum for a political statement. They always have been. But they can't be just that. That can't be the only reason for their existence. That's not enough.
I asked her if there was any atonal music she did enjoy.
There are some very, very good things. Now, there's a couple of operas that are atonal that are really quite nice. Wozzeck and Lulu. Those two are, I think, are really worthwhile. No, atonalism has merit, but it has to make sense to the human ear. If the human ear can't accept it, then you've missed the whole point.
She spoke passionately about this, and in particular about how writing for voice takes a great deal of care.
Well, since I like opera and since I like vocal music, I want the voice to sound good, and I want the listener to hear it and say, "There's something there that's good." I want the singer to feel that he or she has got the message across with the voice. You can produce angry stuff with the voice, but you don't have to destroy the voice to do it. You know, Italian music is so... it's so melodic, and it comes so from the heart, and it's welcomed by the ear, whether it's a folk song or a crazy song or whatever. Even the popular songs they have today are tuneful. And I had one conductor one time say to me, "If you're going to write an opera," he said, "put lots of tunes in it." I said, "You're a conductor. You mean that?" And he said, "Of course." He said, "I want the audience to, they should walk away thinking about one of the tunes they heard, or maybe more. Even if they can't repeat them at that moment, but they'd like to hear them again." And he said, "You don't have to write folk tunes, but it has to be melodic." But again, to hear the voice scream and to reach a high note there and then come way down to one here and then somewhere in the middle, just jumping like geometric gymnastics, it's not satisfying. It's disturbing.
Augusta is also a musician, and she used to do a lot of touring. She told me a story of a time when she crossed the border from Hungary into Austria in about 1982. She was touring with a concert band at the time.
And when we got to Vienna, I thought, oh boy, I would just love to go over to Hungary to see where Béla Bartók worked.
So she got a visa and she got on a bus to Budapest.
I spoke German enough that I had a nice conversation with the driver, and I said, well, when will we be back? And he said, oh, we should be back to your hotel probably about midnight. I said, that's good, because the group leaves 5 o'clock tomorrow morning for the next city.
She made it there without a hitch, and she had a wonderful day.
On the way back, the guard comes on the bus and says in German, to everybody out. So you get out, and everybody has to hand your papers to the guard. Well, the American embassy tells you when you have a passport, you cannot separate yourself from your passport. You must not. It must always be on your person. This guy is 6 foot tall, and he's got a great big gun. I mean, I'm not going to argue with him. Here's my passport. Go. But we had to stand there. We stood there for 2 hours, and you couldn't sit down. You couldn't ask for a drink of water. You couldn't go to the bathroom. You couldn't smoke. You weren't even supposed to talk. So we just stood there for the 2 hours. And finally the guy comes back out, and I'm thinking, I'm never going to get home. Nobody even knows I'm here, which I had told nobody that I was going to this thing. Anyway, the guy comes back out and says, here's your papers, and as I call your name, you can get on the bus. I was the last one they called. I really thought I was going to be there forever. I didn't think I was going to go home. And finally I got back on, so I said to the driver, okay, now where are we going? He said, well, we got to cross the no man's land. There's about a 2 mile distance between this border and the next border, and in the middle of it is a fence that is guarded by a man in a tower. And if he raises the fence, you can go through, and if he doesn't raise it, you got to stay there. So anyway, the guard comes down from the tower and he starts talking with the driver, and the driver gives him a cigarette. And he steps outside the bus and he smokes a cigarette. And I said, are we going to go now? And he said, no. He said, I don't think so, because I made a mistake. And I said, what mistake? He said, I've got a pack of cigarettes still sitting on the dash here. And he said, and I know he saw it and he's going to want that. So anyway, the guard comes back down. They have a few more words. And finally, he gives them the pack of cigarettes and we go on our way. When we get to the Austrian border, the guards there have got 2 cars absolutely torn apart. I mean, the wheels are off inside, the seats are someplace else, and they're dragging these guys off in handcuffs. They were apparently either smuggling guns or drugs. We're not sure which. But anyway, we get through it, and we get back to Vienna, and I got back to my hotel about 3:30, and we were leaving at 5. So, no, I never told anybody in that group that I had done this. They were kind of a stodgy bunch. They didn't like going to Italy, and they just thought, I don't know. They weren't really travelers. They were just seniors who had the money to do it.
Augusta is a prolific composer. In addition to the chamber and orchestral works and art songs you've heard in this episode, she's written a great many operas. One about Joseph Smith, one about the Jelinek family who escaped from Czechoslovakia to Canada in 1948. One focuses on Molly Brandt, a Native American who sided with Britain during the Revolutionary War. I encourage you to check out our show notes page to learn more. The last question I posed to her was whether she had any advice for women embarking on a composition career.
If you want to write, write. But if you want to make money, don't try that. No, don't quit your day job. Make sure you're doing something else, because there's no, unless the world has changed very, very, very much, and I'm sure it hasn't, even men composers aren't really making it. There's just no money in this, because we come from society that believes that, musicians are there to entertain. And you can go to so many free things that nobody even gets paid for. I mean, a lot of musicians don't even get paid for some of the stuff they do, let alone the composer. So, no, just don't give up your day job, but don't quit writing. And don't sacrifice yourself thinking you're going to get ahead that way, because the world out there is pretty nasty. It's not going to respect you. And so you got to respect yourself all the way through. And just keep writing. I mean, there's a lot of music out there that has to be written yet. It ain't all written yet. It And the world needs music. Music is the great hope of everything. It's the cure-all.
Details for each of the recordings featured in this episode can be found on the show notes page at listeningtoladies.com. Just click on the link to the podcast. You'll also find SoundCloud links and links to some of the people and organizations mentioned in this episode. I'm Elizabeth Blair. Thanks for listening.